to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back and to continue this discussion on the spreading of the message after the message should have imploded. And it's kind of funny when you think about how all of this came to be, because it really just should have fizzled out. And when you think of all of the charismatic leaders that thought that they were going to become the next, basically the next William Branham as they're stepping up, from underneath them, this thing started growing and evolving and growing bigger and bigger. And it never really took it over. Charismania won, obviously. But it's kind of odd when you think of how this grew and spread afterwards. And I've mentioned before, my research was heavily focused on, you know, the mid-1800s through 1965 when William Branham died. And then I kind of pick up again in the 90s whenever Branhamism started to come back into the United States through Paul Kane and others. But this area of this area of history that you've researched, it's just fascinating to me. And I'm learning something new every day, even in the conversations we have before the podcast. So this is going to be a wild ride.
I know, John. I'm looking forward to it. These things are very interesting to me too, John. And to me and you, I mean, our families lived right through this period of time. They were connected to lots of facets of what was going on, and they were at the very heart of these things when they were happening, right? And so besides that, I mean, having lived in Jeffersonville our whole lives, we have known the eyewitnesses that were all, we've basically known all the key players through this period of time. So, you know, we've got ways we can put things together just from that. You know, as I think about how the message survived the death of William Branham, like there are several factors I think that are really big keys to how it survived. And I've tried to talk about them in, you know, since we started this new series, up until this point. And some of those factors are, number one, they found a way to plug all the holes in the religion caused by the death of William Branham. And the two sects had different ways to do it, right? The main sect used return ministry ideas as their short-term patch, and eventually they found ways to spiritualize other things, whereas the sect of the message I come from went straight into spiritualizing everything. And so in that way was maybe a little ahead of the curve of what some of the other people in the main sect eventually did. That was one thing. Another thing that helped them survive was the full gospel businessmen. They were there to pour money into the movement at a critical point in time in order to keep it afloat and in order to keep it moving forward. The other thing that was really critical was there were truly 35 message churches with a dedicated group of followers to William Branham, even though they were divided into two sects by the time you come to 1969. And I do believe, John, the schism itself is part of what drove the expansion, because as the two sides are separating, they are a lot. Part of the original push of these guys that are going out all over North America is to get more people on their side to fight the other sect. That was a factor motivating all of this. And they were going out to all the places where William Branham had influence, and they were trying to draw people into their side of the schism. And it was actually that schism that started this first missionary push. I think we mentioned that in our last episode. And as that happened, and they're going out and drawing people into their side of this fight, just a natural side effect of it is they're picking up other people in these churches too, right? Because they're going to a church that had two or three or four or maybe several more than that, even people who were in William Branham's cult following, and they were trying to appeal to them. But as they made that appeal to them to join their sect of the message or their side of things, there's other people in the church that followed along too. So they were drawing the people out of these churches, and they're going all around the broader Latter Rain movement, all around the other places that William Branham was welcome. So even outside of the Latter Rain movement, like the UPC that we've mentioned in other places, Foursquare, and they're just drawing these people out. And in North America, that is how this starts. It is an appeal to the people who were already familiar with Branham, who had been to William Branham's revivals, who had known him, who had actually accepted a lot of his teachings, and who were in non-message churches. And as the leaders of these 35 original message churches go out all around to these places, they're convincing people here and there to separate from whatever church they're in, whether that's the UPC, whether it was Foursquare, whether it was the Independent Assemblies of God, whether it was the Full Gospel churches. They're convincing them to break away from those churches, and they're convincing them to start new message churches in order to prepare for the rapture. Because part of the message is, if you are in a denomination, you are going to take the mark of the beast and burn up. You're not going to get to go in the rapture. So you have to come out of her, my people, right? That's what the phrase come out of her, my people means. You must come out of every group and denomination, separate yourselves in order to prepare for the rapture. That's actually why I titled my book, Come Out of Her, My People, John, because as I would say, when you asked our churches what is the message, we would say the message is, come out of her, my people. It's another phrase for the message. So that's exactly what they were preaching back then. And they were very successful around North America. And as this period we're looking at specifically, 69, 70, 71, 72, in that period of time, we went from about 35 message churches. Here in North America, we grew to several hundred, I'd say at least 200 churches just in North America by 72 and 73, as a result of these preachers going simply to the places William Branham was already known and saying, the prophet has come. Look, 1967 war, Jerusalem has been recaptured. You must separate and prepare, because if you wait till them start building the temple, it's going to be too late. You must separate now. You must prepare now. You must be ready now. The prophet has come. You must have the revelation of the seals in order to have the capstone ministry, in order to go in the rapture. You know, the midnight cry has come. You must hear the shout. Like, you could go through all the message buzzwords. This is what they are doing in 69, 70, 71, 72, in all these places of people that William Branham has touched and drawing out and establishing these churches.
You can see I'm bottling up my laughter. I'm trying to contain it because this is a serious thing we're talking about. But if you really think about what happened, it's like a really bad comedy movie. I think it was in the last episode, maybe the one before that, I used the title that this was like a virus. And I never really, as I was thinking through naming the title of the episode, I realize I've never really expanded upon that very much. But what happens in these churches, it's kind of odd, because the phrase come out of her, my people, when Latter Rain began, it began as the system to create a cult. In other words, you're in the denominations. We tell you that the denominations are cold and formal. You need to come out of her, my people, and join our cult. That's how this began, right? And before that, because nobody would just join this kind of thing, it was instead, everybody's welcome. Every denomination is good. If they draw you out of their circle, draw a bigger circle, draw them back in. And then once the cult began to form, it was now come out of those things that we said were good. So the problem that was created, and it got exponentially worse after William Branham died, the recordings still contain that phrase, come out of her, my people, and that theme, come out of her, my people. And it describes the reasons why you come out of an organized religion, and it goes through the list of things that name them as an organization and as a problem to Christianity in the eyes of the message. Then, after William Branham dies, you have all of these splinter groups, all of these sects. They grow and they build up until they become the very thing that William Branham preached against. And so the mindset is to come out of her, my people. So they come out of that splinter group. And what happens is they create usually a tape home. So one or two or three families, they say, we're coming out of her, my people. Just like the prophet said, we're going to fellowship in this small group. Well, then what happens is they invite friends, and then this builds into a church, and they rent a building. This becomes a movement. This becomes a splinter group until it's time to come out of her again, my people. So this thing grows and evolves. But if you think about the systematic growth and expansion and implosion and regrowth, it's really like a virus. Each little tape home is just a cell of a virus. And then it grows until it turns into something that needs an injection to kill it. And then it dissolves, but that cell is still there. These cells are everywhere. And the areas you're talking about, Belgium, Netherlands, I've had long conversations with news media, national news media in these areas, and they just can't believe that these splinter cells exist in these tape homes. So they went and they started interviewing people, and I think they also use the word virus because that's what it is. This is a virus that the plague is worldwide.
You're very right in how this thing splits and schisms, John. And, you know, as time goes on, it accelerates. I would say by the time you get to 1980, there are multiple schisms every single year since 1980 in the message. I mean, it is nonstop schism. The rate accelerated. It was already, you know, schism you see in 69, 68, but it accelerated as time went on to the point that it is just nonstop schism today, and has been for decades. You're right. And so I think in our last episode, we talked a lot about North America, how the message community got planted in North America. And today, I think, yeah, we want to try and go overseas and talk about what was happening overseas and how some of that, the initial pieces of that happened. And the message as we know it today started really in these years, right? Because as I mentioned, when William Branham died, there was only 35 message churches. The majority of message people were in churches of the broader Latter Rain movement. And you talk about the come out of her my people, how that, you know, still goes on today. Well, that was going on before too, because that come out of her my people message, John, that was part of the Latter Rain movement. Like, William Branham did not invent these things, ladies and gentlemen. If you think so, you've been fooled. The Latter Rain movement was teaching that before William Branham.
Yeah.
And these people in these churches were already of that mind. They had already come out of the denominations when they joined the Independent Assemblies of God. That's what they thought they were doing then, right? These people had already thought they had come out of her, my people, only to discover, oh, wait, the Independent Assemblies of God is another one. We've got to come out of her, my people. And so that message resonated to these people because this is not the first time that they have come out of her, my people. Okay, that's part of why, you know, this didn't happen to them just going up to random people on the street and saying this to them. No, they were going to people who were already familiar with this terminology, who were already familiar with this ideology, who had been influenced by the Latter Rain movement, and this resonated with them. Okay, the message, John, and I think you know this is true, right? The message does not primarily recruit people off the street. The message almost entirely, when it recruits new members, preys like a parasite upon the Pentecostal church world. Wouldn't you say that is exactly how it happened? We don't go convert random people. You infiltrate. They infiltrate a Pentecostalish charismatic type church where all of this terminology and ideology has some existence already. And like a parasite, you suck life out of it. You suck people out of it and convince them you are, you know, yes, you believe. Yes, the gifts of the Spirit, very good. Yes, the Godhead, you're right. You know, they go down the list. But did you know that God sent a prophet? You know, and that's how they appeal to them. And then once they guess, God sent a prophet. Now, you must get ready for the rapture. The Malachi, the prophet Elijah, has come to restore us to the perfect. Come, my brother, come to the message that will get you ready for the rapture. And that is how the appeal happens. And that appeal does not work on the average man off the street very well. But I'll tell you who it does work fairly well on. It works on a Pentecostal or a charismatic from this Latter Rain-ish background. It works very well on them. So that's what's happening in North America. But when you think about outside of North America, John, that don't work so well because the Latter Rain didn't have as big of an impact in Europe or Africa or South America at that time as it did, right? William Branham had toured a lot in America. He had got lots of people in America on his side. And so there was an ability to do that in America in a way that wasn't quite the same overseas. But as we move over to Europe and start talking about Europe today, John, I just hope our listeners will notice the same trend. It is the same sort of Pentecostal type groups where the initial successes happen overseas in Europe. So let's talk about the very first one, John, of how the message spread in Europe? There were three main missionary events or missionaries that led to the establishment of the European message community. And when William Branham died, there was one message church in Europe. It was Ewald Frank's church in Krefeld, Germany. At that time, they did not have their own building. They met in a rented hall, which they continued to do until about 1975 or 74. That's the year they actually built the Krefeld Free Mission. I believe it was 74. It's corrected. I believe it's right in the last edition of the book. So, but 74. But they were the first church, but they were not the only European message believers. And the first one I want to talk about today, John, is a man named Levi Larson. Levi Larson. We mentioned him back when we did the historical research podcast. Now, who is Levi Larson? Levi Larson was one of the international missionaries of the message. He was a Norwegian. He was picked up into William Branham's cult of personality in the 1950s when William Branham did his tours of Europe. And he moved back to Jeffersonville. He was just intrigued by William Branham. He moved to Jeffersonville, and he started attending the Branham Tabernacle, John. And, of course, he absorbed the message, you know, being in the Branham Tabernacle. And through those years, Levi Larson, the way the message churches were here in Jeffersonville back then is they staggered their services, so there was a message church service every single night of the week. So Monday, you could go to Don Ruddle's church. You know, Tuesday, you could go to Metcalf's church. Wednesday, you could go to the Branham Tabernacle service. Thursday, you could come to my church, right? And this is how it was. And then Sunday, you could have your pick. If Branham was in town, everyone went to the Tabernacle. So anyways, this is what a lot of the early message people did. They went to church every single night of the week, John, for years back then. And Levi Larson would come to our church at our midweek service, and he actually met his wife and married someone out of my church. Well, after William Branham died, he ended up on our side of the message schism. And he kind of got disgusted with what had happened at the Branham Tabernacle, and he went back to Europe. He went back to Norway. And when he did, he went back, I believe, in 1968 was when he moved back, right, as that ugly schism was unfolding. It might have been 67. But what he did is he got a hold of a copy of The Deep Call at the Deep Cape from Perry Green. And he would start, he basically do an advertisement in the newspaper that he was going to have a motion picture screening that he would invite the community to come. So he would go from town to town to town across Scandinavia. He would play the Deep Call of the Deep video, and he would invite the local community through the newspaper. They'd watch the Deep Call of the Deep, and, you know, it was the same pitch. Hey, did you see the goiter fall off that woman? Did you see that precious little Carol Ruth Strubler healed of leukemia, who actually died 2 weeks later? And he would convince them, hey, this is the prophet. He's come to Norway, and he's come to Scandinavia, and look, the temple has been built in Jerusalem, or the temple's going to be built in Jerusalem, because the Jews just took over Jerusalem. And the same sort of a pitch, and he would convince them, now it's time to come out of the church that you're in. And the people that he's attracting, John, are, guess who? Members of the Independent Assemblies of God. The Independent Assemblies of God actually had a very strong presence in Scandinavia. And those churches were really who sponsored William Branham's tours over there. And so Levi Larson is touring Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, that area, doing this, and he is planting the original churches of Scandinavia as he does this, using the same pattern that's following over in Europe. He is attracting people who are Pentecostals of the Independent Assemblies of God. He's pointing out the stuff about William Branham. They already have some familiarity with him. And he's convincing them to come out and start their own churches. And as he's doing that, he is also attracting some non-message people to those events. And some non-Pentecostal people to those events. And they're also coming out. And he plants, John, he plants, I want to say, roughly 40 churches, house churches at that time, in Scandinavia in 69, 70, 71, 72. It's a dramatic planting of message churches in Europe. And at the time when they all start, John, they're all churches of my sect, okay? Just the same as Eastern Canada. Later on, we'll explain how they break up and they end up going other sects and stuff, same as Eastern Canada. They eventually broke up and some of them went to other sects of the message. But there at the start, all the churches in Scandinavia were originally part of my sect of the message, John.
And another thing contributing to its spread, if you take the early years of Latter Rain, all of the things that Latter Rain was built upon, specifically the turmoil, the global turmoil that existed with World War II, there were a lot of religious themes that gained a lot of steam, especially in the years shortly after World War II. Those themes made it into the message, and they became core foundation of the message. For example, William Branham's prophecies, many of them are about events that happened in World War II. Well, this grew. You had the women's lib movement, etc., that kind of brought a resurgence to this in the 60s. The themes that William Branham preached against the heaviest became a significant problem in the 60s, and then they kind of faded out. Well, you see this weird reemergence of everything that he was preaching against prophetically in different ways. It didn't come out exactly as his prophecy said, but they reemerged. You had things like the, I think it's the Warsaw Pact, where there's trying to bring peace together. Well, in the mid-70s, there becomes this significant conflict between NATO and the Warsaw Pact treaties, and there's fear that Russia is not going to honor the Friendship Pact. And so everybody starts building this massive arms race, right? Well, these message ministers use this to help grow all of this mess, because they can actually bring in people who've never heard the message before, some of them not even Pentecostal, and say, look, this guy from back in the 1940s is saying exactly what we see right now. And they don't tell them that, no, it's quite a bit different than what he said, because he was referring to a different time period. But they find all of the similarities, they list them, they bring the people in together, and they say, this is what he prophesied. See, it's exactly dead on. And the people get hooked and sucked into the cult before they actually realize, no, this doesn't quite match, but this is a different era, different, everything's different. But the problem is they're assimilated before this happens. So that the world events that were happening in the mid-70s and 80s kind of contributed to the spread of this to non-message people. But then to the people who were in the cults, it solidified their position in the cult, because they see the world events around them. They, too, don't go back to what William Branham and look what he actually said. Does this actually match? Instead, they listen to what the preacher says and they parrot it. So because nobody really goes back and confirms, do all the details of this prophecy match? You have this growing and continuing mess that, like I said, it's a virus that's infecting the world. And it continues to grow through the 80s. What's interesting is as those grew and when they split, they all disavow each other. And so, like, I never knew some of this existed. I never knew how widespread the message was, because we disavowed many of those sects. You were in almost the same city we were in, and I didn't even know any of the people existed. That's how bad this is. So as the virus mutates, the virus itself doesn't understand itself.
Yeah, so the most we would do, right, is just stare narrowly at each other across the blue board, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my. So as Levi Larson is, doing his bit across Norway, it's the same situation, actually, John. He invites Raymond Jackson and my sect of the messages, North American preachers, and they're going over and they're having convention revivals in Scandinavia in 1971, 1972. The same, it's immediately after all the planting happens in Canada. Time-wise, the planting in Europe is happening at the same time as the planting in Canada, but the preachers go to Canada a lot in 69 and 70, but then it's 70 and 71 that they start taking on Europe. So Canada gets the first big emphasis, as these years unfold, and then Europe comes in a year and two later, getting the emphasis and treatment from the North American preachers. Now, there's another thing going on in Europe back then that maybe we wouldn't think about today, but it's worth pointing out. World War II was not all that long ago back then, right? It was still fresh in everyone's mind. Millions of people had been killed by Hitler and all of that. And although Ewald Frank was the first message preacher to have a church in Europe, a large faction of Europe was not, you know, interested in listening to screaming Germans. You know what I mean? So the Allied countries, John, Ewald Frank did not have such a big influence in that part of Europe because, you know, of the, you know, their history with screaming Germans. And so what happens is Levi Larson, like I mentioned, he's working in Scandinavia. Well, there's something else happening in France and Belgium and Holland and Switzerland. There was a, here we go again, a United Pentecostal Church missionary. His name was Anthony Gerritsen. He was in the 60s. He was working in Belgium and the Netherlands as a missionary for the UPC, planting UPC churches. Well, he was not, again, he wasn't outright overtly in the message or overtly preaching the message, but as he planted these churches, he had in his possession a substantial amount of message literature that he had got from spoken word publications, John. And something happens, and Anthony Gerritsen ends up ending his missionary work and going back to America. But as he does, he leaves behind all of his message literature in his office at the church, at a UPC church in Belgium. Guess what happens? The people in the church, after he leaves, goes in his office and they discover the spoken word books that the UPC minister had left behind. And they're thumbing through them and they begin to realize this is what he was preaching to us. And they're like, oh, wow, we found, you know, the source of the revelation. And they start learning about the prophet as they're reading the books, the message literature that the UPC missionary left behind. And what happens in, I believe it's either 1968 or 1969, I believe it was 69, they reach out to spoken word publications and they say, we would like more. Okay, all right, they're hooked now, aren't they, John? We would like more. Yeah. And so, and please send us some missionaries from the message. And so what happens? They start sending message preachers over to this UPC community in Belgium, northern France, the Netherlands, Switzerland. And the message preachers are invited to tour around there. And well, guess what happens? They start to create message churches all through that area. And so how that breaks down, John, is you end up with several, I want to say in the neighborhood of 25 message churches in Belgium, in France, in the Netherlands, in Switzerland, and they eventually move over, they plant some in the UK. But this is what plants the original message churches, John, in that part of the world. They weren't out of Ewald Frank's. This is what a UPC missionary accidentally planted. The message churches in that part of the in that part of the world. I got more to say about it, but I'll let you have a turn.
Yeah, I'm dying laughing, man. The irony of this is so unbelievable because we've talked about it before. William Branham did not understand the Bible that he taught from, and they respect him as a Bible teacher. And so whatever he says, no matter how insane it is, the ministers will parrot that. And one of my favorite mistakes that he made sums up the whole ministry. And it really sums up what this guy did by leaving all of the materials behind. William Branham falsely taught the people to believe that when the Bible says, where the carcass is, the eagles will gather, that the eagles are the good guys and the carcass is his words. That's literally what he taught. And if you understand what that phrase meant to, you know, to the people who don't read the Bible and who don't really understand what the word carcass means, it means where the rotten, nasty corpse is laying. The birds of prey are going to come and rip the flesh out of it because they're birds of prey and they don't eat the good stuff. They eat the rotten flesh. So William Branham taught that his words, the things that were left behind by this minister, that all of these people came, it matches perfectly, man. Where the rotten, nasty corpse is laying, there's where the vultures are going to come. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
As these churches get started in, you know, in this part of the world, in this part of Europe and France and, you know, Belgium and the Netherlands and Switzerland, they form a special relationship with a man named Tommy Dillard. Tommy Dillard was a minister of another Message church here in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana. His tabernacle, his church was called Charity Tabernacle in Fort Wayne. They had actually, Charity Tabernacle was planted, it really took off in, I want to say 69 and 70, right in that same time period. It wasn't too big back then, but it was a church that I believe had actually got started out of. I mentioned there was a radio station in Lima, Ohio that the Message set up, funded by the Full Gospel Businessman. Anyways, that is what I believe recruited his church into the Message. He heard that radio broadcast, they joined the Message. Anyways, he ends up forming a good-sized church, a special relationship with these new churches in Europe that I've mentioned. And they're touring a lot, and he ends up introducing them to Joseph Coleman, John, and a lot of the churches in that part of Europe end up in the Thunders, which we're going to talk about the Thunders at some point. So, but at first, they're main sect, okay? They're main sect, but they're going to turn into the Thunders. So if you think about this now, we've got two Message factions operating in Europe, my sect, the sect that's mostly going to turn into the Thunders, the main sect. And then we've also got Ewald Frank, and he's the one I think we should probably talk about the most, because it's by far the most important. Ewald Frank ends up the leader of the second largest sect of the Message in the world, and a very, very, very important figure in the Message. So his church, John, like I mentioned, in Creffield, his church started out as just in rented halls. It wasn't a building. They didn't get a building until, I believe, 1974, when they built the present Creffield Mission Center there. And what was going on there that let him be so popular? You know, how did he grow so big? And the initial answer, John, is that he had a radio program on Radio Luxembourg. And that program, and maybe some people over there in Europe who are familiar with this might be able to give us a little more information about the frequency, but my understanding, it was a weekly radio program. I believe it was a 20-minute long program on Radio Luxembourg. In that 20-minute program, he would preach a little sermon, and oftentimes he would include things that would attract people to the Message. Radio Luxembourg back then was the most powerful, listened to widely, you know, biggest reach. It could be heard all over Europe, the biggest radio station in all of Europe. It could reach any part of the continent. And it was a German language radio station. And back then, Germany was the most widely spoken language in Europe. So that was, if you wanted to get as most people in Europe as possible, as wide a reach as possible, Radio Luxembourg could reach the largest number of people in Europe. And so just like in the Midwest, you know, the radio station is helping attract people to the Message community. In Europe, Ewald Frank's program on Radio Luxembourg is attracting people to the Message. And as that happens, that opens doors for Ewald Frank across, you know, if you think, The last groups I talked about were kind of in the Allied nations. Well, the Axis nations are interested in hearing what Ewald Frank has to say. Germany, the Germans are inviting him. The Italians are inviting him. He's even, John, sneaking behind the Iron Curtain into East Germany, into Czechoslovakia, into Hungary, into Romania, into, you know, those Poland. He's sneaking into the Soviet countries and also speaking to people there through invitations. So he's basically through that whole, I'll say, Axis Europe and Eastern Europe, he's planting churches and making contacts through that radio program. And as he's invited, he will go to those churches. And he had a very standard missionary sermon that he would preach. And there are copies of his missionary sermons around too you can listen to. And he would basically, he would go the same similar pitch. He would go to Malachi 4. He would say, the prophet of Malachi 4 has come. I was an eyewitness. Here's the things I saw. And what you need to do is you need to prepare for the rapture. To prepare for the rapture, you need his message. And here I am to share his message with you. And so Ewald Frank is basically doing that. And that is how he plants many of the original message churches in, I'll say, Axis Europe and Eastern Europe. And through that period of time, John, I would say he plants, based on what I've been able to kind of estimate and through talking to people, I would say he plants somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 message churches by 1972 and 73. Most of them are house churches. None of them are formal church buildings in this phase. A few of the larger groups have rented halls, but that's what he's doing up through 71, 72 in that period of time. And the very first church building of his sect that actually gets built was built in 74 when they built their own church. And I would say, again, based on what I understand, they grow to several thousand people, perhaps in all of his associated groups, perhaps 5,000 people by 1973, 4, 5, right in there, and perhaps 50 different groups all across Axis Europe and Eastern Europe.
I know it's a tangent, but I have to mention it. Radio Luxembourg, one of the interesting facts about this radio station is that during the war, when the United States was coming in trying to take over, this was used as a United States propaganda machine. It's called black propaganda, where they come in, they take something over, and it operates under the disguise of something other than its intent. But the United States was basically using it to push propaganda to try to sway, basically psychological warfare is what this is. And then when you think about Ewald Frank using this, well, it's using psychological warfare for the message cult. So the connections, it's really weird to think about it. I know that we could probably spin off and do 5 episodes on Ewald Frank and his history and his connections. And we will. His connections to everything we've talked about. I write about him a good bit in my book, From Latterine to Colonia Dignidad, because the spreading of this and the things that are involved when you think of the Germans and post-war mess. I'll just put it like that. It's really unbelievable. And to think that this was embedded in the message and it came in through people like Ewald Frank is unbelievable.
When you realize he is got a program on the American propaganda station, you know he's working with Paul Schaefer in Chile.
Yeah.
We talk about the stuff he's doing in Africa and DRC and other I mean, it's something weird is going on there, John. You know, and I don't like to be conspiratorial. Like, I don't know. I do not know just exactly what. Something is happening with Ewald Frank, okay? Absolutely. And maybe one day we will know the whole story, but today we just don't know the whole story. But something weird is happening with Ewald Frank and what's going on back then. I don't know, you know, and I don't think necessarily that, you know, I'm not saying the United States government believes the message and is promoting the message or nothing like that, but Ewald Frank had something to do with clandestine operations in some capacity back then. I think that is safe to say, but just what, it's hard to lay your finger on it. It's hard to know. It's hard to know what was sanctioned versus, you know, other people have nefarious purposes. There's just so many unknowns there, but Ewald Frank's definitely involved in something clandestine for a large part of his life, if not all of his life. Now, Ewald Frank, for our listeners, Ewald Frank lived in Canada through World War II. He actually moved there before the war started. He had been living there and through the latter rain revivals, right? And that's how he got introduced to all this stuff. And Ewald Frank always spoke very good English, but he spoke English with a Canadian accent. And if you ever listen to him, and now I say that out loud, you'll probably be able to pick it up real easy. But he spoke English with a Canadian accent because he lived so much of his life in Canada before going to Germany to do this stuff. And he was already in Pentecostalism and Latter Rain before he went to Germany. And started doing stuff with William Branham. I look forward to doing a full episode on Ewald Frank and his sect of the message when we have some opportunities, because the really interesting stuff happens after as you get into the 80s, John, with Ewald Frank. The stuff that's pretty interestingly shocking, stuff. So Ewald Frank's passed away. He passed away 2 years ago. He's actually very long lived. So this is 2025 now. I think he died in 2023, I think, or maybe 24. But anyways, Ewald Frank, he had that radio program, that was one of the big things. Another thing that was going on back then, though, John, is that Ewald Frank was very ecumenical. So Ewald Frank worked with my sect of the message. He worked with the main sect of the message. A lot of the schisms that happened in America and was dividing the North American message community, Ewald Frank kind of navigated that in a way that he was able to continue to play both sides of that. So, like, even though here in Jeffersonville, John, or here in North America, my sect of the message and your sect of the message, the twain did not mix. Ewald Frank would invite us, both sects, to come over to Europe and partner with him in mission works. And so what that does, John, is you end up, some of the churches that he plants end up loyal to the main sect of the message rather than to Ewald Frank directly, because the main sect people like Perry Green are coming over and touring to these places with Ewald Frank. Ewald Frank, say he gets an invitation to go visit a such and such a church in Europe. Well, he'll invite Perry Green. Come with me, Perry Green. Or he'll invite Lee Vail. Come with me, Lee Vail. And they'll go to that church and they'll do a joint pitch. And so basically, you have multiple witnesses of William Branham at the pitch. And so Ewald Frank would share what he knows, then Perry Green would speak, he would share what he knows, Lee Vail would speak, he would know what he speak what he knows. He came to joint conventions with Raymond Jackson, John, and so forth. Roy Borders was over there doing stuff with him. So you have this going on. And as they're doing this, the churches they plant develop different loyalties. Some of them to the main sect, some of them to the sect of the message you come from, John, the main sect. Some of them, more to Perry Green. But in Europe, that's how it's breaking down. But Ewald Frank is also doing a lot in Africa. And so is Sidney Jackson. And so I don't know if we want to – do we have time to jump in to start talking a little bit about Africa and what's going on there next? Or should we maybe break that up into another episode? I think we got some more time.
Let's go for it.
All right. So while that's happening in Europe, right, you kind of got three centers of the message, Levi Larson, my sect, Ewald Frank, and what's going on with him. And then the stuff that came out of that UPC minister that's going to end up in the Thunders. You got those three centers in Europe. Sidney Jackson is working with the group that came in through the UPC mission, the UPC guy. Sidney Jackson's visiting them, and they're kind of aligned with the main sect. And Sidney Jackson and Ewald Frank are also working together. Now, who's Sidney Jackson? Let's talk about Sidney Jackson a little bit. Sidney Jackson was a message polygamist. He lived in South Africa. He met William Branham in his South African tours. He ended up coming back to the United States with William Branham at a certain point. I don't know the exact time he moved to the U.S. I want to say it was the 60s, right? They had known each other for quite a few years. I want to say it was about 62, maybe, that he came back to the United States. And he came back right before they moved to Arizona. And then he made the move to Arizona with the Deity Cult, which makes you wonder, right? And so he's out in Arizona when William Branham dies, and he's kind of affiliating with Perry Green. Well, he's somebody that everybody wants to sponsor as a missionary to go back to Africa and help spread the message in Africa, because he had been a minister there, and he's got contacts in the Apostolic Faith Mission. He's got contacts with other different groups, the Independent Assemblies of God groups in Africa, and he's able to start the effort of planning true message churches in Africa. When William Branham died, I don't think there was a single message church in Africa, John. I don't think there was one, which today, the overwhelming majority of the message community is in Africa.
Yeah.
Well, Sidney Jackson ends up sponsored to go back to South Africa, and he went back. Here's what he went back in 65. That's right. Okay, it's coming to my memory now. He went back to South Africa in 1965 before William Branham died, and he was trying to organize the first true message mission work in Africa starting in 65. And he actually had laid groundwork for William Branham to come to Africa in 65 and do a revival series. We know, of course, that didn't work out. William Branham ended up having restrictions placed on his visa. The government wouldn't let him spread the message in Africa. We talked about that in our historical research podcast. But anyways, the first attempt to do mission work as the message in Africa crashed and burned in 65. Sidney Jackson ends up coming back after that for the funeral. And then they all decide, okay, we're going to sponsor you. Hey, fellow gospel businessmen, pony up some money. We're going to sponsor you to go back to Africa and start a mission network in Africa. So that's what happens. Sidney Jackson goes back to South Africa after William Branham died, 66, 67. As the schisms are unfolding here in the U.S., he ends up aligning on the main sect side of the schism. And he, John, is planting message churches and recruiting the very earliest message churches in Africa. He's doing that in South Africa. He's doing that in Zimbabwe. He's doing that in Rhodesia. Basically, the southern third of Africa, English-speaking Africa, is where he's doing that. And at the same time, he's taking occasional trips to Europe. He's visiting message churches in Europe. And we'll talk about, there's a little bit in South America he was doing, but most everything he was doing was in Africa. And he continued to do that up until he died. One of the things that made the message appealing to tribal Africans, John, was the fact that that polygamy was allowed. Okay? Most Christian missionaries going into Africa don't tell them, yeah, you can be polygamous. Okay? Yeah, have as many wives as you want. But the early message missionaries did, John.
Yeah.
Sidney Jackson did, okay? And the polygamy was an important drawing card to the early message communities that were established by Ewald Frank in tribal Africa, okay? Now, the very original message people in Africa were either white or Indian, right? I am not aware of any African message believers. I'm aware of white African message believers and Indian African message believers from those early days, but I'm not aware of any African message believers when William Branham died. They were all recruited after he died, as far as I know. And Sidney Jackson is the guy planning all of these there in South Africa. Now, there's more I want to talk about, but that's the first group. And you, Sidney Jackson died in, what, he died in 84, I think. He died not too terribly long after William Branham, maybe 15 years after William Branham. But he passed away early on, and most of the churches that he planted ended up aligned to the main sect of the message, loyal to Voice of God, or some of them loyal more so to Perry Green. But it's the same thing. And Ewald Frank and Sidney Jackson, as he did his tours, he would invite Ewald Frank on some of those. Ewald Frank developed connections through that. Perry Green came on quite a few of those tours. And so anyways, that's how a lot of the very first African churches in the southern tier of Africa got started.
And an interesting fact about Sidney Jackson and his connections to the NAR, for the people who are looking at this podcast and the research as it connects to like Bethel Church, etc. The Apostolic Faith Missions, that's the group that's planted by John G. Lake. So when he went over into Africa and he, you know, he's escaping the murders of that were happening in Zion City. If you read that research, it looks pretty well that that's what's going on. And he creates this fake stage persona. You can go read the critical examinations of John G. Lake's history. He's doing some schemes. I'll just say it like that. William Branham himself got somewhat sucked into this through people like Sidney Jackson, because they could invite him over and speak to the broad Pentecostal audience. And like Charles said, the message was very compatible with the polygamy sects that were growing. And back in the United States, nobody really knew that William Branham was doing this. He was actually supporting polygamy in Africa, and then he'd come back to the United States and he would somewhat pretend, but yet not outright say, that polygamy was wrong. So you find many message ministers in the United States today who will fight and say William Branham was against polygamy. In fact, I think there's a letter from Voice of God headquarters, if I remember correctly, that says something to that effect. But the people in Africa remember what he said, and they go back to the sermon Marriage and Divorce, where he says that there was a covenant of polygamy described in the Bible, and that's what they stand upon. So this grew into this big mess. But what's really weird, Charles, William Branham's fame kind of fizzled out after sanctions against him because of the Latter Rain movement. And he never really grew to the same popularity that he had before those sanctions. But now in Africa, he's actually extremely popular, more popular so than when he was alive. And you can go look it up. I've seen a few of them, but there are national Christian television networks in Africa that are playing message ministers and having interviews with them about William Branham. And it's grown into this weird thing where he's dead, but now he's more popular in Africa than he was in the United States when he was alive.
I was reading some interesting stuff about John Lake here recently, and one of the things that I came across, and it seems to be true from different sources, was that John Lake's wife died of malaria while he was in Africa as a missionary. And after he died, John Lake took a underage concubine, I guess is what you'd call it, John. And in that sense was a pedophile child molester, okay, on a younger girl after his wife died. And that actually played a role in him being needing to come back to the United States because the news of that got out in Africa, what he was doing. And so he had to leave, you know, that and come back to America. So John Lake is, there's so much stuff about him in the message they never told us. They never told us about the people he killed in Zion. They never told us about his financial schemes that he went to jail for. They never told us about the underage pedophilia when he was in Africa, okay? So John Lake is so problematic now that we look at him in the way that's the truth. And Sidney Jackson, Sidney Jackson is a polygamist in the Apostolic Faith Mission who was converted during the days that John Lake was in South Africa. And as this message polygamist, converted into the Apostolic Faith Mission, he then joins the message when William Branham comes to town, and then becomes the lead message missionary in the southern portions of Africa after William Branham's death, and plants the early message community in that region. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a good history.
You can't make this up.
This is not a good history. It's so much of it, and there's so many things we could say, John. So many things we could say.
It just fits the pattern of a God's general.
it does, doesn't it? You know. So he is one missionary, John. He's the most important missionary in Africa, but he is just one. So a few years after he gets going, so like I said, he started his mission stuff in 66 and 67 in Africa, and you know, and it gradually grew. Another missionary was a man named, we called him Brother Trench. I have looked and looked trying to figure out what his first name was, but we always just knew him as Brother Trench. He was a, surprise, surprise, a UPC missionary working in Africa, John.
Am I hearing a pattern here?
You're hearing a pattern, John. A UPC missionary working in Africa. And he you know, as the message preachers are going around UPC churches and convincing them to come out of Remai people, he is a UPC missionary that decides to come out of Remai people and join the message. Well, he's in Africa when he decides to come out of Remai people. And he actually ends up, and I have tried to figure out just how this happens. He ends up connecting to my sect of the message, John. And he starts organizing in the same areas that Sidney Jackson's working. I would my hunch is that Sidney Jackson converted this guy to the message, but I'm not sure. He ends up reaching out to my sect of the message and inviting them to come to the southern portions of Africa. And so Sidney Jackson's got a head start in the southern parts of Africa. Then Brother Trench invites our churches into the southern part of Africa. And so now you've got the two sects competing, John, in the southern portion of Africa. And while Sidney Jackson has a lot of the white message community, and he's doing mission work to the African or the black message community, black people in Africa, my sect of the message comes in and they start doing outreach, especially to the Indian message community. There's a lot of Indian people in the English parts of Africa, especially back then. So my sect of the message, John, also plants a number of churches in the southern portions of Africa, you know, working through the Brother Trench. And so that's happening in that same period of time, you know, up into the early 70s. Now, there's another another thing going on, too, that we should mention, and it is the Independent Assemblies of God. So the Independent Assemblies of God had a lot of missionaries operating in Africa back then, too. Independent Assemblies of God. If you remember, Independent Assemblies of God is the denomination which A.W. Rasmussen and Joseph Mattson Boze were the leaders of. The flagship church was the Philadelphia Church in Chicago. The Independent Assemblies of God was the main branch of the Latter Rain movement. Sharon Orphanage had joined Independent Assemblies of God. Most of the early message churches had been in Independent Assemblies of God. So, if you want to think about it, it was the Latter Rain denomination that had all these missionaries working in Africa in the Independent Assemblies of God. Well, the two areas where they were most especially focused back then was East Africa, so like Kenya, Somalia, you know, that area, Uganda, and then also what I guess you would call West Central Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, that area. So those are the two areas where there's a lot of Independent Assemblies of God missionaries working. And just like UPC, I'll say even far more so than the UPC, the Independent Assemblies of God is universally embracing of William Branham as a prophet, okay? There is not a single Independent Assemblies of God church that thought bad things about William Branham. William Branham was beloved, not in the sense that the message beloved him as, you know, as the great end time prophet, but they beloved him as a true prophet of God. And they're circulating his literature, John. The Independent Assemblies of God missionaries in those areas are circulating message literature. And so people in Africa start to get an awareness through Independent Assemblies of God ministers of William Branham's teachings, of his sermons, and so forth. And that starts to open doors where some of them reach out for mission opportunities where with Ewald Frank or with Sidney Jackson or to the other groups of the message. And one man in the area of Ghana, Ghana, Nigeria, that area, is a man named John Humphrey. He ends up working with my sect of the message, John, and they plant quite a few churches in Ghana and in Nigeria. Ewald Frank's coming down in there. Same thing. He's visiting Ivory Coast. Ewald Frank was fluent in four different languages, and he had through his church a lot of different translators. And they're just visiting all of these different African countries, and they're planting message churches all throughout that region, John. And so while Sidney Jackson's maybe in the southern third of Africa, these guys are in the central parts of Africa, spreading it. And I would say by the time you come up to 73 or 74, they have probably planted somewhere in the neighborhood of, I would think it'd be safe to say, 200 message churches in Africa. They were small, you know, not big churches, but by the time you get up to 75, 76, they've planted lots and lots of churches. And by the time you get to the 1980s, African's are the majority of the message community I would say by the middle 80s. That's when that transition happens. So the growth in Africa is just absolutely explosive. And when you think about that too, John, so I was involved in a lot of the work in our sector, the message to know how this worked, okay? Like we know how all this worked. There was a couple different things that I think maybe affected this. And I'll just use one of them. So financially, John, you could start a message church in Africa with loyalty to your sect of the message back in those days for about $10 a month. Okay? Very, very cheap. Okay? And you know, and over time it grew. By the time you get to the 80s, $25 a month. You could have a message church in Africa. If you take just that small amount of money and you offer it to an African preacher to be a missionary to outreach for your sect of the message and your branch of the message, that was enough to take them from dirt poor to the richest man in their town. That was all it took. And that's all it took, John, to have a message preacher. $10 a month, $25 a month. And when we are talking about all of this money coming in from the Full Gospel Businessmen, all the money coming into some of these larger churches, that's all it took. And for a few hundred dollars, you could sponsor dozens of preachers in Africa. And it's the same thing in the Philippines and the same thing in some of the South American countries and India back then, too. You could sponsor a preacher to spread the message. And that is absolutely what happened. They would go in, they would identify people, and they would basically... Sidney Jackson set up a little seminary where he would train African people to spread the message and be preachers, and he would give them credentials. And if they did, they would get this little allowance of $10 a month, or, you know, as time went on, it grew, and they would go out and they would do mission work. And if you think about it, John, in that sense, you know, it's good to maybe spread the gospel of Jesus, but of course they're spreading the message of William Branham. Think about it like an investment. Because this is what happens. This is absolutely what happened. For $10 a month, I've sponsored this person to go out and preach. And of those preachers, a number of them are going to successfully plant some really big churches. Okay? And when they do, they're going to then develop tithe revenue. Okay? Now, when that preacher is now getting a substantial amount of tithe revenue coming in, right, he is going to then tithe back to home base. And this is what happens.
Yes.
Okay. For some minor investments, okay, you plant the churches and over time they're a net loss. But then as time moves on, they grow. They're no longer a net loss. They're actually tithing more back to Jeffersonville or whatever message center planted them more than is going in. And this is beginning the process of bringing money back to the core in the United States. And so this, it's not simply that out of the goodness of their heart, all of these people are spreading the message. It is profitable. It is profitable. And this is absolutely what's happening, John. And the message centers back here in the United States in Jeffersonville, I know our church was getting substantial tithe revenues out of all of these foreign churches, all these churches we set up. The same was happening to the other Voice of God, Spoken Word, Tucson Tabernacle, Cloverdale, okay? All these places that planted out these churches were tithing back to the message centers that planted them. And so that's another big thing driving this outreach.
I'm glad you brought up the business aspect of this, because I think that's highly overlooked whenever people are researching this. Because if you talk to the people in the message, they're going to tell you that, yeah, this is not a big money-making operation. You can look at the people like the Kenneth Hagins of the world, and you can see all this, you know, the charismania that has all of the lights and glamour and money and big mansions, etc. It's not really the same model when you look at the message ministers. There are a few that have, you know, big mansions, etc., but most of them, who are by far the wealthiest, don't really show it on the outside. So you'd look at them and you'd think this is just a poor preacher who has no money, or a poor head of an organization who has no money. They've got a lot of money. And if you think about the business strategy behind it, there's a reason why they have so much money. But we grew up thinking that all of these people were poor, that the organization had no money, and they played it off pretty well, because they, at the headquarters, they would bring in all of the children and they would do children's crafts instead of about Jesus. They would be like crafts about William Branham. It was weird now that I think about it. But they would tell the kids, now, we need to have you take home penny jars because we need money and we're trying to develop a tithe system and we're going to train you young and we need penny jars. So create a penny jar, and if you have a friend over, they can drop a penny, whatever it is, you know. And so when you're thinking pennies, you're not thinking that they have millions and millions of dollars coming in. And if you look at the tax statements, they have a good way of expensing it out. So you don't see how much of it's moving out either. And so you get this wrong vision of what this thing is, thinking they're just doing God's work. But no, this is a business. It's a business strategy. The whole thing has, it reeks of business strategy. It's pretty bad. But there's much more to get into. I think we'll cut it off here, because next episode we get to talk about what happened in South America, which is fascinating to anybody who's, especially if you've read the book on Colonia Dignidad, or if you're familiar with the documentaries on History Channel, etc. It's a fascinating story, so I'm excited to get into that one.
I'm looking forward to it too, John, because we've still got to talk South America, we've got to talk about India, we've got to talk about the Philippines, we've got to talk about the Caribbean, and hey, well, I think we can throw some Australia and New Zealand in there of what was happening in these years, because we're going to explain how the message got planted in all of the world. That way people can know how to connect the dots.
Yeah. It'll be fun. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about the history about William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.